Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Hosteds Lee Buys Raleigh Mansion. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the front page. On the far left, there's a picture of the outside of the mansion, showing the large fountains in front of the mansion and the stone front. The caption reads, Peter Lofton built his manse after making a fortune in telecommunications. The sprawling Falls Lake estate that self-made billionaire Peter Lofton lost in foreclosure last spring has been sold to one of Raleigh's newest self-made millionaires, Hosted Solutions founder Rich Lee. Lee in December paid $2.95 million for the nearly 18,000 square foot mansion off Raven Ridge Road, and he is negotiating to buy the remaining 50 plus acres surrounding the house for development. The home, which features swimming pools and tennis courts, was built for a reported $18 million in 2000 and is one of the largest homes in Wake County. Lofton first began trying to sell the home and surrounding land in 2008 when he listed it with a Southern Pines real estate agent with an asking price of $32 million. By 2009, he had lowered the price to $20 million. Lee has teamed with Bost Custom Homes owner Rex Boss to pick up where Lofton left off in 2008 with plans to subdivide the property into 21 lots and create an exclusive luxury residential community. Pete's vision for the property was dead on the money, but unfortunately the economy was not quite there for the development, Lee says. Hopefully we can rectify that. Lee built his fortune through the growth of his Raleigh-based Hosted Solutions Data Center Operations Company that he started in 2001 with 13 employees. He was the company's major shareholder, president, and CEO until he sold a part of his ownership in 2008 to Boston, the private equity firm, RB Partners, for $144 million. Then in December 2010, Windstream Corporation of Little Rock, Arkansas, made a $310 million all-cash offer to buy Hosted Solutions, and Lee agreed to sell his remaining share of the company. He wouldn't disclose details about his final take in the deals. I wasn't ready to sell the whole company or retire when Avery made their offer, but when Windstream came along, I knew it was time, Lee says. At 45 years old and with more than 10 years in the technology industry, Lee says he is ready for a career change. I guess you could say that I'm an unemployed real estate developer now. The sale of Lofton's mansion decouples the final link that the gregarious entrepreneur had with Raleigh, a city where Lofton built a telecom company called BTI that once had a market capitalization of $1.7 billion. I am very happy that someone actually will be living in that house after all these years, said Lofton when contacted at his home in Miami. I was a billionaire when I built that house. As to the way he lost the house to creditors, Lofton says he simply wanted to move on. I put my heart and soul into that house. After a while, I wanted to put all that behind me. Boss says the home has fallen into disrepair in recent months because creditors shut off the electricity. Weeds have begun popping up through the cracks and sidewalks around the pool. But it's still a beautiful home and resort, Boss says, but big homes require a lot of maintenance. Lee says he hopes that he and his fiancée can move in by the summer, adding that he intends to keep a penthouse condominium he owns in downtown Raleigh. As for the surrounding residential development, it will be called Alpine Creek Estates. Boss says he's familiar with the property because he had previously been working with Lofton on his plans. I am just tickled to death that we seem to have the perfect buyer, Boss says of Lee, who was introduced to Boss work when his company built a wine cellar in the downtown condo. We still have a lot of stuff yet to be worked out, but I think it will be one of the most unique neighborhoods Raleigh has ever seen, Boss says. And now moving on to the rest of the stories on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the next set of articles takes up the rest of the front page. Below the article we just read, all the way down, The background is beige, a yellowish beige. And then most of the page is taken up with the headline, Johnson Unplugged, in bold red lettering, with a Progress Energy symbol next to it. Then under that, there's a picture of a man sitting at his desk, dressed business casual. Under that, a sub-headline that states, CEO William Johnson, the utility will remain here, and we will have a substantial presence. Now, this article is written by John Downey with a Dateline of Raleigh. Bill Johnson wanted to be a dentist, ended up a school teacher, went to law school on a whim, and found himself fast-tracked for the top job at Progress Energy Incorporated. Now, he's likely to be chief executive of the nation's largest power utility if Duke Energy Corporation's proposed $16.7 billion purchase of Progress closes this year as expected. He likens himself to the accidental tourist of the utility industry, but that self-mocking assessment takes no account of his toughness. He lettered as an offensive lineman at Penn State. His discipline, he lost 120 pounds in a single year to improve his health. Or his intelligence, he graduated summa cum laude from Duke University. He'll probably need all those attributes as he works to persuade regulators, investors, customers, and employees that the blockbuster deal he and Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers have signed will be good for them, and then knits the two proud utilities into a single enterprise. Some things are known. The merger will bring layoffs. Some are not. How many jobs will be cut? Those changes will hit the Carolinas, particularly North Carolina, hardest. An email sent Tuesday to Progress employees in Florida says, most of the efficiencies are expected to come from the consolidation of Carolina's resources. We do not anticipate major staffing reductions in Florida. Johnson says the companies have not come up with any set number of layoffs in Raleigh or Charlotte. First, they must decide how to design the combined company, he says. The merger focuses on $600 million to $800 million in savings on fuel and operating costs in the Carolinas over 5 years. The benefits to Duke's Midwest operations and Progress's Florida franchise are less clear, but Johnson doesn't foresee problems with regulators in those states. Basic questions of company structure remain. Progress divested its unregulated energy businesses several years ago, believing its best investments were all in regulated utilities. So how will Johnson, as CEO, look on Duke's international business in South America? Will he want to keep Duke Energy Generation Services, which develops and operates commercial plants for utility and industrial customers, and houses Duke's burgeoning commercial renewable energy business? And the question of what to do with Duke's merchant fleet in the semi-deregulated state of Ohio remains open. Johnson talked about his career and how he views the merger of Duke and Progress. What follows is an edited transcript of that conversation. What do you expect your first few months at Duke to be like? First thing is for the Duke folks to get to know me, and maybe even more important, that I get to know them. At the same time, what's really important to me is that we have a common belief, that we're aligned around the strategy, and we all understand our role in executing it. What would you say is the common strategy? We have a lot of work to do to understand what our options are, but I have a pretty clear view of that mission of serving customers, serving investors, serving employees. With this combination, the Duke entity moves in a more regulated direction. It's obvious that most of the growth in the company is in the regulated businesses, but there are a lot of things that we just don't know about today about what we will do. The future of the international businesses, some of these things, they are questions we haven't engaged yet and won't until we get to combine the company. The proposed merger seems to be very much predicated on the idea that you know you are in a rising rate environment for the regulated utilities, and this might be a way to slow that a little bit through fuel savings and efficiencies. I think that's one of the essential ideas here in the deal. You can see a rising rate environment. A lot of our equipment is 50, 60 years old and simply needs replacing. There are new environmental standards. And so when you combine like this, you get two things. If you can achieve good credit status, your cost of borrowing is lower, and that goes directly to the consumer, and you can be more efficient. What questions are you getting about the merger in Raleigh? What questions are you getting in Charlotte? The questions in Raleigh come in various forms. The mayor, the chamber, they want to know what this means for the city. We tell them our philanthropic footprint will remain the same. The utility will remain here, and we will have a substantial presence. The headquarters of the combined company will not be located here, and that will have some impact, and we'll do everything we can to mitigate that. The company question is, what about me? Not usually said like that, but there is anxiety and uncertainty. What I tell them is, as I know more, you'll know more. I have focused as CEO on being fair. That will remain the standard. In Charlotte, I would say the questions from the employees are the same. There are some questions about who I am, what I believe, and how I will act. That's to be expected. The community questions are a little different. The community leaders see this as a positive for Charlotte, so they're a little more excited about it. Is there a document floating around that says as many as 1,000 employees could be let go? If there is such a document, I have not seen it, and I am not one to avoid detail or not read things. So if the advantages of this deal among neighboring utilities are so clear, things such as the fuel savings, why haven't we seen more deals like this, and could it lead to more in the future? It could be a bellwether, but any merger is hard to do. The regulatory approval process is difficult, so you don't do this lightly. People like their companies. There are always social issues. If you're going to combine two companies, one of the CEOs has to go. Those kinds of things. Mergers are very opportunistic. So here, Jim is old enough to move on to the chairman's role. I'm young enough to be the CEO. That's not the deal. It just makes it easier. You can talk about the deal. There are a lot of factors. Over the years, Duke has seemed the more aggressive company. It has moved faster on nuclear plants. It has taken the lead on pressing for state and federal energy legislation. Historically, Progress has been a low-profile company. Part of the difference is you have Jim Rogers there. He's been a CEO a very long time. He's nationally prominent. It's hard for someone 3 years in the job to come into that kind of media attention. And it hasn't been necessary for us. In this area, we have been surrounded by much bigger companies, Southern, Dominion, Duke, and we sometimes benefit from the work they are doing. So the question becomes, can you switch gears? Sure. I'm actually very active politically. I do understand that when you're the head of the biggest company in the sector, you have a leadership role that you have to pay attention to. I have a great interest in how the company runs every day, so I do have a large internal focus. That won't change, but a bigger and more public role, I actually welcome it. And I should mention the writer, John Downey, is a reporter with the Charlotte Business Journal, a sister publication. Now, right next to that article, to the right of it, there's another article related and on this same background of a yellowish beige. The headline, Sale Scotch's Building Deal. This article is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh, and it runs vertically on the right side of the page. Underneath the article, there's a picture. It's a nighttime picture of the outside of a building where you can see most of the windows lit up by the lights inside. The caption reads, Bank of America Building Sale Was Called Off. Uncertainty surrounding Progress Energy's consolidation in downtown Raleigh has scared Highwoods Properties away from the purchase of a major downtown Raleigh office building. Sources say Raleigh-based Highwoods was within days of signing a hard contract attached to a $10 million non-refundable deposit to buy the One Bank of America Plaza building when Progress Energy on January 10 announced its plans to be acquired by Duke Energy of Charlotte. The fear is that a flood of space could open in the downtown office sector due to the merger of the two facilities. Progress leases about 800,000 square feet in two buildings downtown, and it's unknown how much space the company could vacate following a merger. The 17-story One Bank of America Plaza Tower is next door to Progress Energy's headquarters building at 411 Fayetteville Street, so any new vacant blocks of space could potentially compete for future office tenants. It is expected that the building sale could fetch a price of at least $48 million. Highwoods Property spokeswoman Kelly Macon would neither confirm nor deny that Highwoods was the intended buyer. But Highwoods officials have indicated in the past that they are interested in growing the company's downtown Raleigh portfolio. Highwoods is one of the largest suburban office property owners in the Southeast, and it currently owns only one building in the downtown district, the RBC Plaza Tower. The Simpson Organization of Atlanta purchased the 367,225-square-foot One Bank of America Plaza building in 2005 for $47.1 million, and investors decided to put it back on the market last fall. Grubb and Ellis Company has been hired to market the property to investors. Downtown Raleigh Alliance President and CEO David Diaz concedes that it is a buyer beware environment right now regarding the uncertainty of Progress Energy's buildings. But there's still no doubt that it's a great building. If someone has backed out of buying it 3 years from now, they might be kicking themselves in the rear. I firmly believe this is a short-term phenomenon. Vacancy levels in the downtown Raleigh submarket are among the lowest in the Triangle, staying consistently below 8% over the past few years, which compares to a 19% vacancy rate for the Triangle office market as a whole. The downtown Raleigh vacancy rate in the fourth quarter of 2010 was 7.3%, with only 277,000 square feet of space available among an inventory of 3.8 million square feet of space, according to Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space survey. Occupancy at the One Bank of America Plaza building was nearly 97% in the fourth quarter, with a tenant mix that included Bank of America, Absolute Collection Service, and the Hunton and Williams Law Firm. Eric Berkman with Grubb and Ellis Company in Washington, D.C., would not comment on whether the building was still under contract, but he did dispute any fears from the investor community. Being removed from the market, I know a lot of people are concerned about what's going on with Progress Energy, but we are still very bullish on the Raleigh market, Berkman says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off: red carpet will be rolled out for NHL owners. And under that, there's a the All-Star Game emblem, symbol from the NHL. And then under that, the column starts. Not only are the All-Stars coming to Raleigh, so are the big wigs, as in the owners of National Hockey League teams. These folks who sit as the league's board of governors in making key decisions expect to be treated in style, and plans have been laid to do just that. Biz hears they'll be feted to a dinner hosted by NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman and Carolina Hurricanes owner Pete Karmanos at an undisclosed location in Durham. Meanwhile, Carey's posh the Umstead Hotel and Spa will host board of governors meetings during the All-Star weekend. And the good betting is that the Umstead is where the owners will lay their heads at night. Draft Magazine, which follows the beer business and the culture of beer, says two of the nation's best 100 beer bars are in downtown Raleigh, in the form of the Busy Bee Cafe and the Raleigh Times Bar. Of the Raleigh Times, the mag says, "This bar is Raleigh's Belgian hub. Set your sights on beers like Great Divide Samurai Rice Ale and as many as 100 Belgian bottles from Victinar Out Red to Troubadour Obscura that pair exquisitely with down-home chow like beer-steamed pastrami on rye. Classy yet casual, this versatile spot's an easy choice for a first date or just your average beer session." And of the Bee, "The Busy Bee is one of the brighter spots in Raleigh's electric beer community. Its exposed brick walls and rafters create an urban draw, but it's the beer that really fills the seats. Nearly 80 bottles, including highly sought-after brands like Mikeller Beer, Geek Breakfast, and Cascade the Vine, fill the fridges, while 14 taps round out the upstairs and downstairs bars." You can understand if attendees at the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitor Bureau's recent conference table meeting on January 13 felt like they were jet-setting off to London. The quarterly meeting of the Advocacy Group for the Visitor Industry was held at Raleigh-Durham International Airport's Terminal 2. And when it came time for lunch, flight attendants who work American Airlines' RDU London flight served the meal. Not coincidentally, the food was the same that served on the transatlantic flight: salad, beef fillet with foyer sauce, and an ice cream sundae. beats the heck out of tea and crumpets, that's for sure. Looks like the LED bulb doesn't fall far from the tree. Chuck Swoboda has been having success on the East Coast with his light-emitting diode company, Cree, and it seems his brother, Mark Swoboda, is finding similar success on the West Coast, heading up Intimatics. The Fremont, California-based company makes powdered phosphors, which are used to make LED lights and other illuminating displays. We've been growing over 50% per year for the past 5 years, says Mark Swoboda in an interview with TBJ's sister publication, Silicon Valley Business Journal. With the two holding down LED forts on both coasts, Biz is bound to hear more from these illuminating brothers in the future. Pop quiz time. Which major college conference had the most former players selected for this year's National Football League Pro Bowl? Biz will quietly hum the theme to Jeopardy while waiting for you to guess the much-ballyhooed Southeastern Conference. But as it turns out, the SEC isn't the correct answer. That would be the Atlantic Coast Conference, which boasts 19 former standouts in the Pro Bowl. They include former NC State stars Phillip Rivers and Adrian Wilson, as well as former UNC Chapel Hill star Julius Peppers. The SEC was second with 13 selections, followed by the Pac-10 with 12. The Big Ten and the Big 12 each had 9 selections. This is the third straight year that the ACC led all conferences with the most selections. The Pro Bowl will be held January 30th. UNC Chapel Hill is losing its top bean counter. Dick Mann, Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration, will retire on June 30. Chancellor Holden Thorpe has appointed a committee to find a successor. Mann has served at UNC since 2006. Prior to that, he worked for 10 years as Vice President for Administration at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, as well as a 20-year stint at the University of Kansas. Biz reckons maybe Mann got tired of all that red ink. Women's clothing boutique Modern Times at University Mall in Chapel Hill will close when its lease ends on January 31. Modern Times started out 25 years ago out of a Franklin Street store featuring designs by Lisa Markison, the founder. Designer collections from New York shows followed. Hillary Fisher bought the operation in 2004. It's time for a change, Fisher told the Chapel Hill News. She cited increased competition from the likes of Streets at South Point Mall in Durham and Tanger Outlets, which recently opened in Mebane, as a factor in the closing. Niles is coming to Chapel Hill. Television, theater, and film actor David Hyde Pierce, best known for his role as Dr. Niles Crane on the TV sitcom Frasier, will be on hand to accept a local award on February 12. Pierce is being given this year's Playmakers Distinguished Achievement Award by Chapel Hill's Playmakers Repertory Company as part of the theater company's annual fundraising gala. The historic Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill will play host to the actor during a black tie event with the Valentine's Day theme. The gala will feature an award ceremony for Pierce, followed by dining and dancing to the music of the Bill Bolin Orchestra. Past Playmakers honorees include actors Eva Marie Saint, Faye Dunaway, Hume Cronin, Louise Fletcher, and Billy Crudup, and New York Times critic Frank Rich. Hotel operator Concord Hospitality Enterprises Company has bought out of foreclosure a Wakefield office building that it will use for its headquarters after a summer relocation. Concord has been operating out of about 16,000 square feet in the Forum Office Park in North Raleigh since relocating the company from Ohio 8 years ago. President and CEO Mark Laporte says he has staffers having to telecommute from home because there's no space to add more people at the Forum. He expects Concord will need most of the 33,000 square feet of space in the two-story building that Concord Corporate Center LLC purchased this month for $2.52 million. Concord also bought the adjacent 2.3-acre lot on Common Oaks Drive for $500,000, according to deed records. Raleigh real estate developer Nutan Shah had been an investor in the properties before the buildings went to a foreclosure auction in December. The properties had a tax value of almost $5.7 million. Want your child to do better in college? Have you tried paying him or her? A study has found that students who are able to earn money based on their grades perform better than their peers, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education. In the study, which was published in the National Bureau of Economic Research, first-year and second-year students at an unnamed Canadian university were paid $100 for each grade of 70 they earned, plus $20 more for each percentage point above that. The incentive had the greatest effect on second-year male students. 2011 could be a turning point for the restaurant industry. According to a report by research firm Technomic Incorporated, the firm says it expects U.S. food service sales to grow by 1.7% from 2010 and dip by just 0.3% when menu price inflation is factored out. That would compare to a sales decline of 3.7% in 2009 and a flat year in 2010. Opening of a new school is not such big news in Wake County, where growth has had them popping up like mushrooms after a heavy rain, but a school opening is notable in Chatham County. It was front page news, in fact, in a recent edition of the Chatham News, which noted that the Margaret B. Pollard Middle School opened its doors to 480 students and 50 staff members. The school at 119,945 square feet can hold up to 650 students. Its name honors a former Chatham County commissioner. Contributing to Biz were staffers Cameron Snipes, Chris Baisden, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Dathan Kadzuk. And now we return to the full-length articles inside the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to, UNC Hospitals wants to modernize ORs. And this article is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with a Dateline of Chapel Hill. The article runs horizontally across the top of page 3. At the far left, there's a picture at night of the outside of UNC Hospitals, outside of the building. The caption reads, UNC Hospitals operating rooms are too small. When designers were drawing plans for UNC Hospital's operating rooms, they didn't have to worry about all the image-guided surgery equipment, microscopes, and ceiling-mounted monitors that are required in ORs today. That was then, and this is now. UNC officials are evaluating what they will need from the 20 operating rooms in the oldest buildings on the hospital campus in Chapel Hill. The hospital currently has 31 operating rooms and will add 4 in February when an expansion of the ambulatory and surgical center opens. Modern operating rooms, on average, need about 600 square feet of space to accommodate, hospital design experts say. By comparison, UNC Hospital's oldest operating rooms average between 275 and 375 square feet of space, says hospital spokeswoman Karen McCall. We'd like to have a little more space, she says. UNC Healthcare, which operates UNC Hospitals, has taken the first step in modernizing the OR rooms by issuing a request to architectural and engineering firms interested in conducting a feasibility study to evaluate options. Once a design firm is chosen, the hospital can develop a plan on how it will enlarge its operating rooms, as well as provide more pre- and post-operative space. Neither a cost estimate nor a timeline for the UNC project has been set yet, but the cost could exceed $20 million based on estimates for similar construction projects. Construction of one new operating room could cost anywhere between $1.1 million to more than $4 million, according to proposals submitted to the state's Certificate of Need office in 2010 from hospitals competing for 3 new operating rooms in Wake County. For now, UNC Hospitals is not planning to ask for state permission to add operating rooms, McCall says. According to the state medical facilities plan for 2011, which outlines projected medical facility and equipment needs across the state, only 2 counties in North Carolina, Columbus and Rowan, have a projected need for an additional operating room, each by 2013. But UNC hospitals could potentially seek an exemption under certain circumstances since it is a teaching hospital, says Mike McKillop, an analyst for the NC Department of Health and Human Services, which works in the state's Certificate of Need program, which is aimed at holding down health care costs. Regardless, however, the expansion plan would require a Certificate of Need application and approval, since OR projects are expensive, McKillop says. Most medical facility projects that exceed $2 million must first meet the requirements of the state Certificate of Need law. Many hospitals are looking into the use of existing space instead of new construction, says Lou Jerkowski, CEO of the BJAC architect firm in Raleigh, which has done work with 14 hospital groups across North Carolina. Hospitals have a heck of a lot to think about, she says, referring to the new federal health care reform laws and reductions in reimbursements for medical facilities across the country. No one really knows what's going to happen. Jerkowski says she expects more hospitals across the state will be focused on renovations and small expansion projects in 2011 instead of the big new building projects that preceded the recession when nearly $2 billion in new hospital and medical research buildings were completed. They want to be more efficient, and architects know how to get the most out of the square footage they have, Jerkowski says. And now we move down page 3. We come to an article in the center of the page. Has a black border around it. Inside that border, the background is a greenish beige. First at the top, there's the beginning of a headline that says, Regional Rail System Rising from Old Ashes. Then under that, there's a picture of a train going by a building. The caption reads, Unlike the Triangle, Charlotte got its rail lines rolling. And then under that, there's the main headline in bold black lettering. Added stations, Transit Group expands regional rail plan. Now, this article was written by Chris Basden with the dateline of Research Triangle Park. There's no more money to pay for it, and no guarantee there ever will be. But regional planners have crafted a preliminary map of a regional rail system much larger than the one that failed to leave the station 4 years ago. Plans are being developed by Triangle Transit Engineers, working with San Francisco-based URS Corporation, which has a $7.9 million design contract, show a system divided into three projects, a light rail system in Wake County, a light rail system in Durham and Orange counties, and a commuter rail system that would connect the two light rail systems. If all three projects under study are built, there would be a total of 35 miles of light rail and 37 miles of commuter rail stretching across the triangle, says Triangle Transit spokesman Brad Schultz. The overall system would feature a total of 37 light rail stations and 12 commuter rail stations, though some of the light rail and commuter rail stations would be shared. That's significantly larger than the 28-mile with 12 stations that was envisioned for years before being ditched in 2007. Under the new scenario, commuter rail service would operate primarily on existing tracks, and new tracks would be laid for the light rail lines. Where the stations go is of importance to local real estate developers. Transit boosters say stations can act as magnets for mixed-use development projects where users would live and shop. I think ultimately when transit comes, it will increase the value of land around the stops, says Tom Darden, CEO of Raleigh-based real estate investment firm Cherokee. But what of the station sites themselves? Schultz says in an email that the amount of land needed for each station would vary greatly, from as little as an acre to as much as 15 acres, depending on factors including the location of the site and the number of parking spaces needed. Triangle Transit estimates that it will need a total of 180 to 220 acres for the stations. The authority already has some of the land it needs. Triangle Transit previously bought 111 acres of land it had hoped to use in the now defunct rail project. The plan for that system was shelved after it failed to win a long-term federal funding commitment. Depending on the final configuration, Schultz says that 60 to 90% of the land already purchased could be used for the new project. The stations would include platforms, canopies, benches, and lighting. Schultz says overhead pedestrian walkways and elevators also may be needed, as well as a few parking structures. The cost per station will range between $4 million and $7 million, depending on factors including location and station configuration. After the previous rail plan was deep-sixed in 2008, a special transit advisory committee proposed broad strokes for a comprehensive bus and rail expansion that would cost about $2 billion. But these days, planners aren't certain how much they'll have to spend on the new project, if it gets built at all. The General Assembly has given Wake, Orange, and Durham counties the ability to hold referenda on a half-cent local sales tax that could be used to fund the proposed system. Yet sales tax projections took a significant hit during the economic downturn. Suffice it to say, we've got plenty more ideas than we've got capacity to pay for it, says Ed Johnson, the director of the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. Transportation planners across the region are trying to assemble detailed rail transit plans that could be presented to voters by the fall, when some advocates would like to see referendums held. But voters, the business community, and local politicians may not be in the mood to hold such referendums, given the high unemployment rate and the state budget crunch. Are we going to be there? Asked Wake County Commissioner Joe Bryan. That's yet to be determined. And just to the right of that article, we have an article that runs vertically along the right side of the page. First, at the top, there's a picture of a man in a suit and tie standing outside of one of the federal buildings downtown. The caption reads, Dan Gerlach says 2010 was a strong year. And then under that, the headline, Leaf Cash Lures Legislative Stare. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Rocky Mount. Finances perked up during fiscal 2010 at the Golden Leaf Foundation, which chalked up double-digit gains in investment returns and total assets while handing out 122% more in economic development grants. The performance all but erased a down year in 2009 when all three indicators dropped, including investment returns, by a whopping 142%. Golden Leaf President Dan Gerlach was upbeat about the results. 2010 was a strong year for us in terms of rejuvenation of the endowment and making grants, he says. The coming year, however, could bring political pressures on the 11-year-old nonprofit, which annually receives 50% of the state's share of the national tobacco settlement. The economic development grants it makes with the cash are aimed at helping rural areas move away from a tobacco-based economy, but some in state government would like to see that money diverted for other uses. The administration of Governor Beverly Perdue is reviewing a list of 150 boards and commissions as part of a wide-ranging effort to restructure state government. Perdue spokeswoman Chrissy Pearson, who says the list will be made public in coming days, wouldn't exclude Golden Leaf from the review process. But just because something is reviewed doesn't mean it will be cut, she adds. It simply means it's time to take a look. Meanwhile, at the General Assembly, with lawmakers eyeing any and all possible sources available to them to help make up a budget shortfall in the range of $3.7 billion, renewed calls to pull the plug in Golden Leaf wouldn't come as a surprise. Previous legislative attempts to do just that frequently have made it into bill form, but never out of committee. That could change this year. It's going to be like a vacuum cleaner over there trying to find money. I don't expect anything to be sacred, says Smithfield Republican Representative Leo Daughtry. I can't say Golden Leaf hasn't been doing good work. They've made some good grants, but they have made some questionable grants too. Senator Richard Stevens, a Republican from Cary and one of the incoming co-chairs of the Senate Appropriations Committee, says everything will be on the table in the effort to come up with a balanced spending plan. We are taking a comprehensive look at all state programs, and Golden Leaf will be reviewed along with everything else. Gerlach, meanwhile, says his organization will work on both sides of the aisle. Whatever lies ahead in 2011, the foundation moved forward on all cylinders in the 12 months ending June 30, despite receiving $14 million less in settlement cash from the major cigarette makers. Golden Leaf's key revenue sources are those annual payments, plus any returns it can generate from an investment portfolio that was at $639.5 million as of June 30. fiscal 2010 investment gains, up 12%, were $66.8 million, compared with loss of $141.6 million in 2009, as foundation managers sank more assets into U.S. treasuries and international stocks. The numbers are included in a newly released independent fiscal 2010 audit performed by the accounting firm BDO. Total assets rose by 15% to nearly $644 million over the prior year, but remained 12% below where they stood in 2008 before the recession. In other highlights, the foundation awarded economic development grants totaling $71 million to various groups, up from $32 million the prior year. Among those grants was a $24 million allocation used to leverage three times that amount in federal money to expand the broadband network in 69 mostly rural counties. Paid off the remaining $15 million of a $100 million loan used to build the Spirit AeroSystems jet body assembly plant at Kinston's Global Transpark. Our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Equity Investor Halifax Capital After $350 Million. With venture capital funds still making little noise on the fundraising front, the Triangle stable of private equity investors has been showing signs of life. The latest is 11-year-old Halifax Capital, which has filed documents with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, revealing that it has kicked off a $350 million fundraiser. Halifax, which had nearly $530 million under management as of 2009, draws a large share of its investors from the institutional ranks, including endowments and pension funds, and operates out of a trio of offices in Raleigh, Washington, D.C., and Dallas, Texas. It has hired New York-based XT Capital Partners to assist it in raising money from institutions and family offices. The fundraiser is expected to last more than a year. We have a blend of investors, says Halifax CFO Michael Marshall, who heads up the Raleigh office and is also a member of the firm's investment committee. The feedback from the market has been very strong. A lot of people want to invest in this mid-market space, which is where we are. Halifax's investing most often comes in the form of mezzanine and leveraged buyout infusions. The group invests nationally. Local deals include a now-exited investment in Raleigh-based National Packaging Solutions Group and currently a $35 million infusion, along with Boston-based SV Life Sciences, which committed an equal amount, into Raleigh-based Trio Clinical Research, a drug research services company to the pharma industry. Trio was rolled into another corporate entity, Virginia-based CR LLC, which, through a series of additional acquisitions, Marshall says, is going to become the next generation CRO. Once the acquisition phase has been completed, he adds, the renamed entity may also relocate. Halifax is among a group of private equity players, either based in the Triangle or with a presence here, that have been busy laying the groundwork for future investing rounds. Other local private equity developments have been the formal closing out on December 29 of a year-long $165 million fundraiser by Raleigh and Charlotte-based Plexus Capital. Of the total, $56 million came from private investors, with the rest coming from a 2-to-1 match under a Small Business Administration lending program. Our partners see substantial opportunity in the current tight capital markets, says Plexus General Partner Bob Anders. We believe this new fund is an affirmation of our business model. The father-son team of William and Merritt Moore in December formally launched Lookout Capital, a consortium of private equity investors who pay a fee for the right to invest on a deal-by-deal basis. It has 25 investors in the fold. Total investing potential in terms of available capital is not known. Raleigh-based Triangle Capital Corporation TCAP, like Plexus, an SBA registered lender, reported $74 million cash on hand as of September 30, enough capital to fund its activities for the next 12 months. On the venture capital front, meanwhile, if any of the area's major startup investors are planning a 2011 fundraiser, none has yet signaled the intention by filing with the SEC. In that group is Durham-based Inner South Partners, Hatteras Ventures, and Pappas Ventures, and Raleigh-based Southern Capital Ventures. The Triangle's other two funds, Aurora and Wakefield, are overseeing existing investments. We have no immediate plans, says Jason Kaplan of Southern Capital. We are still in the middle of investing from our second fund, looking for more opportunities and traveling more. With two exited investments last year and a stake in the Motra City IPO, he adds, 2010 was a good year for Southern Capital. And on top of that, we have just turned 10 years old, he says. Alfred Williams to return to downtown Raleigh roots. This article is written by Cameron Snipes with the Dateline of Raleigh. And I should mention, mixed in with this article, there are two pictures. And the caption reads, rendering bottom shows planned renovation. And the top shows a old black and white picture of the building. Office furniture company Alfred Williams & Company is moving its headquarters and 50 local employees to downtown Raleigh, near the spot where the company was launched more than 140 years ago as a bookseller. The company, one of the oldest in the city of Raleigh, hopes to complete the move from its current headquarters on Capitol Boulevard to a building at 410 South Salisbury Street by summer. Alfred Williams & Company bought the 60,472-square-foot building in mid-December for $2.6 million from a company owned by Raleigh businessman Tom Hendrickson. The company will occupy 15,000 square feet on the second floor, with hopes of leasing the remaining square footage to other businesses. It's a smaller space than Alfred Williams' 32,000-square-foot presence on Capitol Boulevard, which it has occupied since 1979. But the new space will allow the company to operate more efficiently, says Blunt Williams, the family-owned company's fifth-generation chairman, CEO, and president. Founded in 1867, Alfred Williams & Company opened up shop on the first block of downtown's Fayetteville Street under the leadership of the company's namesake as a stationer and bookseller. Through the years, the company evolved into a full-service office services company, providing supplies, machines, and furniture to offices throughout the Triangle and surrounding areas. Today, after various operational changes, the company focuses solely on office furniture and is one of the largest Herman Miller dealers in the nation. The company employs a total of 220 in 9 offices throughout North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee. The Salisbury Street building, now a nondescript structure with few windows, will be gutted and outfitted with a significant number of windows. Architectural drawings call for a large Herman Miller logo etched into a second-story plate glass window, and a two-story silhouette of an office chair painted on the back of the building, which fronts Gale Street. David Diaz, head of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, is bullish on Alfred Williams & Company's decision to move back to downtown. It has a great significance for the real estate market in downtown, Diaz says. The history of Alfred Williams speaks well of the future of historic buildings in the downtown area. Raleigh Mayor Charles Meeker echoes that sentiment. Alfred Williams has been a great stakeholder in our community. I think it's great for Center City, Meeker says, adding that he's starting to see a big retail shift in the area. And now we turn to the executive profile in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. And this profile is of Carrie Howe Stoltz, Triangle Market President, Bank of America. The headline on the article, B of A's face in the market, a native, a mover, and a doer. And to the right of the article, there's a large picture of Carrie Howe Stoltz in business dress, sitting in her office. The caption reads, Carrie Stoltz grew up in Raleigh and attended Wake County Public Schools. This article was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. when Carrie House Stultz arrived on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1987, she and a few friends who had played junior tennis in leagues around Raleigh wanted to continue the sport. We couldn't play on the school's team because it was so competitive, so we formed our own team, Stultz says of the UNC Tennis Club, which lined up matches with club teams from Duke University, Elon University, and Salem College. Through that experience, Stultz became more engaged on campus, finishing her senior year as president of the Panhellenic Council in charge of the Greek organization on campus. Stultz's natural gravitation toward leadership roles has served her well throughout her career and personal life as she has climbed the ranks of one of the largest banking institutions in the country, Bank of America. In May 2009, the bank named Stultz market president of the Triangle Region, serving as the bank's face before business, civic, and philanthropic organizations in the community. Stultz sits on the boards of no fewer than a half dozen education and economic development organizations and provides advisory support for several others, including the Junior League of Raleigh, the Lucy Daniel Center for Early Childhood, and the YMCA of the Triangle. She helps decide which groups are deserving of grants from the bank's charitable foundation and helps keep Bank of America's leadership engaged in the Triangle. It's a role that fits Stultz like a glove because she's a Raleigh native and a product of Wake County Public Schools. It's exciting to see what the area has become, Stultz says. Rick Brown, Bank of America's city executive for Durham, has been working with Stultz for about 10 years. He says she has the knack for making others around her want to jump on board for her causes. She's got a lot of energy and passion for what she's doing, Brown says, and she has a real passion for Raleigh and the Triangle. Doug McMillan, executive director of YMCA of the Triangle, says that when he approached Stultz about joining the group's board of directors shortly after her promotion, he found out she was already supporting the organization's missions. She had been a staff mentor at our Camp Seafair, and her daughters were taking swimming lessons at the Alexander YMCA downtown, he says. Our board members don't just occupy a chair, they are engaged and are helping us to become much better. In addition to her duties as Triangle Market President, Stultz still serves as a senior client manager for the bank's global commercial banking group. In that role, she works with a range of interests from hog farms to technology giants. In college, it was her parents who insisted she take a class in accounting, which set the groundwork for her first interview with the North Carolina National Bank, NCNB, which evolved to become Bank of America. I was planning to go to grad school, but the dean of students recommended I interview, so I got my resume together and borrowed my mom's suit, she remembers. From the resumes I sent out, it all boiled down to banks. NCNB sent her through a training program in Charlotte before assigning her to work at a bank branch in the Gaston County town of Dallas, near Charlotte, and Stultz had been climbing the corporate ladder ever since. Debbie Clark of Raleigh met Stultz when, as bank trainees, they roomed together in Charlotte. It doesn't surprise me at all that she's done so well with the bank, Clark says. She's always been incredibly put together and so genuine. Another longtime friend, Lisa Marie Farrell of Raleigh, echoed Clark. Carrie has always got both sides of the brain working, Farrell says. She's super smart, and sometimes people with smart brains have a hard time relating on a personal level. Not so with Carrie. And our next article that we'll just have time to read part of is written by Chris Basden with the Dayline of Raleigh. The headline, North Carolina Judge Rules North Carolina Business Tax Penalty Unconstitutional. A North Carolina business court ruling slams the State Department of Revenue for imposing a $1.2 million penalty on Food Lion parent company, Delhaize America Incorporated, that the judge determined violated both the U.S. and North Carolina constitutions. The case sheds a light on the practices of NCDOR leadership, who, despite requests from their own employees, declined to provide requested tax guidance, apparently due to concerns that companies would use that information to lower their tax bills. The overall ruling in the case, Delhaize America, Inc. versus Kenneth R. Lay, the former Secretary of Revenue, was a mixture of good and bad news for both parties and likely will leave neither side completely happy. But in a larger sense, the case turned out to be a victory for multi-state corporate taxpayers that have been frustrated over the past decade by the department's aggressive but opaque tax collection principles. I think that the judge Tennille thought that the Department of Revenue was being unfair, says Mark Finkelstein, a Smith Moore litigator, who adds that the decision could embolden more companies to challenge NCDOR's decision to penalize them. Finkelstein is familiar with the ruling in the case, but was not involved in it. The case revolved around a tax dispute between the department and the Salisbury-based Food Lion, which is owned by the Brussels, Belgium-based Delhaize Group. According to the ruling, Delhaize was one of a number of firms that in the late 1990s undertook corporate restructuring initiatives designed to reduce the amount of taxes they paid to the state. Tennille's opinion says the NCDOR responded to the numerous restructurings by changing its policies, but the judge concludes the department didn't inform taxpayers and failed to provide its staff with updated guidelines, which left its own auditors confused. And we'll stop there as the rest of the article goes into more background information. And we'll instead use our final few minutes for the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Investor blasts Cisco on human rights. Activist investor Boston Commons Asset Management says it has sold most of its 167,000 shares valued at $3.5 million in Cisco systems because of the tech company's human rights record in China. The investment manager, with about $1 billion under management as of March, according to the SEC, says Cisco equipment sold to the Chinese Ministry of Public Security was used to clamp down on electronic speech and dissidents' communications. Boston Commons also claims Cisco used deceptive vote counting methods to downplay the results of a shareholder-initiated human rights plank in a recent proxy vote. Boston Commons, which released a statement on the divesting move, says it has been in the lead of a coalition of investors representing over 20 million Cisco shares that has been raising questions about the company's human rights record for the past 5 years. Cisco, in a statement, responded that the company continually evaluates and addresses human rights issues within our business operations and in communities where we operate. Toxic waste candy recalled. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued a recall notice stating that an Indianapolis company is recalling all toxic waste brand nuclear sludge chew bars because of elevated levels of lead in cherry chews. The products were made in Pakistan. Circle City Marketing and Distributing, which does business as Candy Dynamics, issued the recall. Airlines projected to post $4 billion in profits. The top U.S. carriers will report their largest profit, nearly $4 billion in a decade, in fourth quarter earnings reports starting this week, according to estimates by industry analyst website AirlineFinancials.com. The $3.95 billion profit will come on revenue of $122 billion from the eight largest U.S. carriers, Delta Airlines, American Airlines, United Continental Holdings, U.S. Airways, Southwest Airlines, JetBlue Airways, Alaska Air, and AirTran Airways. With the exception of Alaska, all of those carriers serve Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Cary CRO brings in Merck executive. Cetero Research has named veteran Merck scientist and executive Roger N. Hayes president of Bioanalytical Operations, the Cary-based clinical research organization announced Wednesday. Hayes has spent the past 10 years as director of bioanalytical at Schering Plough Research Institute, part of Merck Research Laboratories. Merck bought Schering Plough in 2009. Cetero focuses on conducting early-stage clinical research on drug candidates. Cree shares tumble as earnings miss target. Shares of Cree Incorporated tumbled nearly 15% after the Durham-based LED lighting company released fiscal second quarter financials that failed to meet expectations of Wall Street. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.